This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1974, Huey Newton, the head of the Black Panther Party, went underground to escape charges of assault and murder. In a controversial move, he handed the leadership over to Elaine Brown. Brown has just written a memoir about what it was like to lead a macho, male-dominated revolutionary outfit. She had worked with the Panthers since 1968. The Panthers were a black militant armed organization founded in the 60s. The FBI virtually declared war on the Panthers. Some members were killed during police raids. Many of the party's leaders were arrested. Brown has lived in France for the past 3 years, but she's visiting the States to discuss her new book. Today I spoke with her in Philadelphia, the city where she spent her childhood. I asked if the men of the Panthers resisted taking orders from a woman.
The party was a paramilitary structure. And so people were pretty much willing to take orders as orders came and not question them. So in order to get around that, there would be side comments. And I mentioned in the book that one man came up to me and said that he could not call women by a derogatory term anymore. Was that true? Imagine that he was addressing this to me, a woman, but he hadn't really realized that he was, because I was the leader. But he's talking about these day-to-day women in his mind. And I had had to issue an actual order as to the internal discipline that men could not call women the B word anymore, among other things.
How would you describe the Panthers to someone who either didn't know the group or didn't understand it?
And there has been a lot of misunderstanding for those who have even heard the name. I don't want to start with a negative, but just generally, we were not a racist organization, and that's very important. That is to say, we were not anti-white. As a matter of fact, we considered ourselves to be internationalists, and that the struggle that we were waging or that we wanted to trigger embraced the concerns and the problems of not only black people, but of poor white people, of Asian people, and women, and whatever. That was our overall base of people. As to our ideology, we considered ourselves to be a revolutionary in the sense of the elimination of the system of capitalism, and specifically in America, the dismantling of the government and the whole capitalist scheme. This was the big, broad statement, all of which was to encourage people to take a look at the disparities in a very concrete way and to begin to move to eliminate those disparities.
Well, you had control over all the guns and money in the party. How much of each was there?
The money was, at the time that Huey left, I calculated, as I indicated in the book, as I looked at the bank accounts, there was about $1 million sitting around. But there was many millions of dollars in property. As far as the guns, I indicate the kinds of guns that we had, and I would say that, you know, we had into the many thousands of guns.
To understand what the Panthers meant to you personally, I want to go back to your childhood.
Yes.
And find out a little bit about what it was like for you when you were growing up. You grew up in North Philadelphia. You live with your mother and your grandmother. You grew up on welfare.
No, I didn't.
I thought you were on welfare.
Except my mother specifically said it was called relief in those days.
Yeah.
And my mother, who was a factory presser, never ever accepted relief money because she considered herself to be above that. And she used to say to me, I'd rather starve and steal or steal than beg.
Now, you were a very bright student, so you went to a special school. The school was predominantly white.
Yes.
What impact did it have on you to go to this school, to be introduced to a very middle class world, among other things?
Pretty much, almost. Well, in my mind, it was almost upper middle class, because you had children coming from, in those days, Bala Cynwyd and from Cheltenham and so forth.
Yeah,
so,
these are suburbs.
Yeah, of Philadelphia, because it was not a local school or neighborhood school. Mm-hmm. It was this experimental school. Well, the impact was very easy. I mean, once I got to know the children there, naturally they became my playmates. And I can recall, as I do recall, that the initial thing came with a birthday party, or Halloween party, rather, that I went to one of the girls, a classmate's house, and the first thing that struck me was that she had so many lights in her house, that the house wasn't lit up with 25-watt bulbs, and it was bright, and that there was carpeting there, and that there was, later I learned, I saw another friend's house in which there was a refrigerator, and these things came to symbolize not so much luxury, but this well-being, this other life that I had no—I didn't know that people only had I thought everyone lived like me because one only knows one's own world when you're young. But now I know that there is this other world, and I wanted to enter that other world with everything in me and leave the old world.
And that meant to you trying to be white in a way?
Not even in a way. It really meant being white. I mean, it was the most difficult part of this book for me to write was to admit and to acknowledge that I did want to be white, not so much to be white. It was not so much difficult to admit that I wanted to be white, but to admit that I did not want to be black, that I hated myself so much, and I hated, therefore, my people so much, at least from the extension of that, that I actually dreamed to be white, not even in color, but to live like white people. And therefore, I had to become like white people.
You moved to Los Angeles when, I guess, was it after high school?
Well, a couple of years after. I was 22.
And you ended up being a waitress at the Pink Pussycat in L.A. What kind of place was that? And tell us what you had to wear as a waitress.
It was so ostentatious and flashy and cheap. It's incredible to think about. But it was making a lot of headlines because Johnny Carson at the time was who had just moved his show from New York to Los Angeles, found this name and just thought it was absolutely hilarious. And so he didn't miss a night when he didn't invoke something about, well, I was down at the Pink Pussycat. So it sort of gained a status that it didn't have in terms intrinsically. I mean, it was an incredibly gauche and ugly, tacky place to be. On the other hand, there was a lot of money being thrown around there. It was a strip club. It was not a nude show. It was a strip club with the old strippers with tassels on their breasts and, you know, doing bumps and grinds and this kind of stuff right out of Gypsy Rose, you know. And the girls and those of us who were the waitresses, and we were certainly the girls, we wore a Merry Widow bra for a top, which we stuffed the cups of. With paper or whatever. Some people use socks or whatever to give us an extraordinary, pardon me, bosom line and very, very high heel shoes. And there was a certain glamour to that job because it was hard to get that job because these girls were making a lot of money.
Glamour. You went to a party at Frank Sinatra's house.
Yes, ultimately I did. Not ultimately. 2 weeks after I had started working there because of this Johnny Carson stuff, a lot of movie stars were coming there. It was at least that year's thing to do, if not that month's thing to do. And everybody would come in, and everybody was excited, and Sinatra came in with an entourage. And after the first show, there were two shows, and introduced me to Sinatra, and whereupon I was invited to a party at his house.
Now, while you were working at the Pink Pussycat, you met someone named Jay Kennedy.
Yes, through Sinatra. Actually, he was part of the Sinatra party that night.
And he was a writer?
At that time, he was a writer, yes.
And also a businessman?
Actually, he had been a union organizer. Jay Kennedy had been so many different things, but this I learned through bits and pieces. At the time, I considered that he was a writer.
Now, what's really interesting to me about your relationship with him is he was a white man, an older white man.
And as it turns out, he was Jewish, but I didn't know that until about 5 years ago.
But he's the one who kind of introduced you to black consciousness.
Amazingly, isn't it?
How did he do it?
Well, he started out by the very first night we had dinner, he invited me to dinner, and I was sort of thrilled. I mean, this was a whole world of, you know, money and power that I had sort of stepped into quite by accident. So I was fascinated by him. I didn't think of his age one way or the other. As a matter of fact, that was very comforting for a person who'd never had a father or never really had a relationship with a father. And he began talking to me about the March on Washington because you realize this was, 65. So the March on Washington had been 63. So this is pretty much, the civil rights movement was very much on the minds and in the mouths of everybody in the country. And so he asked me if I'd been in the March on Washington, and I thought, well, what does this have to do? No, I haven't been to the March on Washington. About, you know, my people trying to gain their civil rights, and I had no idea what people he was talking about. I was so confused in my not black, not white world. And he began to talk to me about that, and eventually Stokely Carmichael and the sort of rise of this sort of SNCC and moving into the black power, call for black power. And he was talking about the whole business of social conditions in America and actually in the world, and then beginning to tell me about communism versus capitalism or socialism versus capitalism, all of which lived in the abstract in my mind, but nevertheless it was being pounded home into my brain pretty much every day, because he was very much of an activist in the civil rights movement, and he was very much a believer in a change in America. So yes, here I am, a black woman being educated by a 55-year-old white man about social conditions in America.
The real paradox is when you really, the deeper you got into thinking about black consciousness and civil rights, the more you had to leave him in a way.
Well, because, I had to. And he recognized that, as I indicate, he wrote a book later called The Chairman. Well, he'd been writing that book. And when I received a copy of the book later, it was incredible to see the chapter about the white male protagonist suddenly having a black female girlfriend who goes off and becomes a black militant.
What appealed to you about being a militant that the civil rights movement didn't have for you?
Personally, despite all of my notions about being white or not being white, I did come from my roots, my base, my character has all been formed and based upon my relationship with North Philadelphia. I mean, I was a girl of the streets. I knew how to walk the streets and act on the streets. And so the streets meaning urban America, urban black America, where after the Great Migration, most blacks ended up being, as I think of it, stuffed into these areas or cordoned off, if you will, into these areas, almost like in internment camps. And so my style and my character was already that. And to see a policeman putting an attack dog on a black person, and who is just saying, "Yes, we shall overcome." Well, this had nothing to do. I had an automatic response to somebody who was aggressive with me, and it wasn't to sing any songs. So that, and many black people felt that way. There was a real difficulty among most black people, especially in the North, to really think to themselves, I will let these people put hose me down with water or whatever. No, the immediate reaction is on a day-to-day basis, the idea is to defend yourself at all costs because you're so confronted all the time with violence anyway, that the idea that you would accept violence nonviolently was just literally not part of our thinking. And it certainly wasn't a part of my thinking.
My guest is Elaine Brown. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Elaine Brown is my guest, former head of the Black Panther Party and author of a new memoir called A Taste of Power. Now, you say you saw feminism as a white girl's thing.
We all did. We all said that anyway. Secretly, we didn't know, but openly, because we would be abandoning our brothers, we felt. And so, therefore, it was something for white people to discuss. But we black women, we were with our men. And as I even say, I remember on a wall in Chicago, I saw this all over Chicago, men must change or die. And I thought that was just, you know, that was just like the ultimate either or problem or solution kind of thing. It was actually very funny to me. But we decided, we black women, especially those of us as part of any kind of progressive movement, decided that we would be abandoning our duty if we even spoke about our rights as independent from the rights of our brothers, even though our brothers were at the time speaking about claiming their black manhood and the word womanhood was sort of subsumed or presumed in there, but actually we found that it wasn't so much in there, but it was very clearly our black manhood was a key, pardon me, phrase within the Black Power movement. So our notion was that we would be abandoning our brothers if we separated ourselves out, and that this was an issue white women had the luxury to discuss, that we were in emergency and we had to do emergency tactics by joining together.
Did your feelings change at that during your stay in the Panthers or afterwards?
Well, certainly my feelings have changed a lot since then. But during the time that I was in the party, bit by bit, I began to open my eyes, or my eyes began to be opened, that this was not an issue to be dismissed into the, well, we'll deal with that after the revolution is over, a sister world. Because that was usually the other response. Yes, it's true that, you know, there is a disparity between men and women, but this is for after the revolution, meaning this is truly a secondary issue. When we are really free, we will argue these cultural points, and that was how we all thought of it. Only when I was in the leadership of the party and there was no authority over me, there was no government, no person that could claim authority over me, because I was not only the absolute leader of the Black Panther Party, but I was a person who could direct the Black Panther Party to do this or that. And so there was no one to look to. And when I came into that position and I realized that I was a person unto myself and I had a taste of power, and then I began to realize what was happening to me now only because I was a woman, and I became very, very angry about it.
Give us an example of one of the things that happened to you because you were a woman.
There were the general things within the party, as I said, a brother saying to me, well, we can't call them the B word anymore, and that sort of thing. Later, when I had to fill certain gaps in the party leadership in terms of certain administrative roles, I put women in those positions, or I put people that I thought were the best. And they turned out to be women. And so I started getting a lot of feedback and a lot of grumbling about, you know, what are these women doing taking over our party? And so it became clearer and clearer to me that most of the people thought of a member of the Black Panther Party as a man, as opposed to as a comrade, as we all referred to ourselves. And finally, or not finally, but one of the nodal points, or one of the points that really triggered my consciousness, was when I was running for office for city council in Oakland, and there was another man running, a black man, and he began to assail me as a lesbian because he said I had put so many women, and he said the people knew that I really liked women. And I started really thinking, why was he saying this? And what, you know, were people saying this? And I really became personally tortured by this. And suddenly it occurred to me that the whole thing had to do with, as I indicate, valuing women and valuing myself, ultimately.
The Panthers were an armed revolutionary movement. Were you comfortable with guns? Did you learn how to use a gun when you were with the Panthers?
Well, I had a gun all the time. I did learn from the party. I said I didn't learn anywhere else. I wasn't in the Army or anything. And where else are you going to learn how to shoot a gun? I wasn't, I had no access to guns before the party. And no, I wasn't afraid of the guns, because these guns, in my mind, were an instrument of resistance and perhaps deliverance. Not these particular guns, because we imagined that if there had to be armed struggle. But the guns that were in the hands of party members, these people were my friends. So, I mean, it's like having Officer Friendly come down if you learn, when you think, well, this man has a gun, but this is not, what is this? I mean, you see guns everywhere in America. This is a violent country. All the police are armed and double armed. All the federal government officers, I mean, there are just guns in the American scene. But those guns make me nervous, because those guns are not serving any interests of mine, and certainly not protecting any interest and protecting me. And these guns were exactly the opposite. They were guns in the hands of my friends that might keep us from all being killed.
Were you ready to die for the cause?
I really thought that I was. I mean, no one is necessarily looking forward to death, but truly there was a moment at which, when you realize that what you believe you are doing is so significant, that the fear of death is overwhelmed by the idea that perhaps your death will be meaningful.
What was it like to be a mother in this kind of armed, violent atmosphere?
Well, the atmosphere wasn't so armed and violent. We knew we had guns, but I mean, these guns weren't, people weren't wearing guns every day. I mean, it was just, we were ordinary people. We had eventually, I should say, we developed our school for our children. Because when we started in the party, we were all very young. And most of us, with the exception of people like David Hilliard, didn't have children. We didn't come to the party all packaged up as parents and everything, and then taking our whole families with us. Most of us came in individually and very young. And then we began to have children. And then we began to figure out, what are we going to do with these children? So we created a school. We created first daycare centers and childcare centers. And as our children got older, we realized they could not, and we did not want them to go to the public schools. So our children knew very, they lived in an extraordinarily protective space. So I don't think half of them had any idea in their childhood. They knew what the Black Panther Party was, but they didn't have to be confronted in any way with anything that smacked of danger or violence. As a matter of fact, we did everything we could to keep them over on the side and away from harm.
Why did you leave the Panthers? When did you leave? Why did you leave?
I left in the end of 1977, and I left the incident that triggered my leaving was that one of the women in the party had been beaten up very severely by some men in the party. And she had been one of the hardest workers in the party. And I wouldn't have even known about it, which tells me something, but I wouldn't have even known about it if another woman hadn't called. So now, not only am I not the person in authority, when Huey Newton had come back, but women are now again being beaten and with authority. And this was incredible to me, especially given that so many of the brothers had become so completely out of control after Huey got back, and they felt that they had gotten back their real leader and didn't have to be burdened with me anymore. And when I talked to Huey about it, he was very unconcerned, nonchalant about this beating, and this woman was hospitalized with her jaw broken. And I said, you know, what is happening here? You know, there's some disparity or division between the men and the women. And he said, you know, and what? What's your point? You're fine. What do you care? And that was when I knew I had to leave because I saw the handwriting on the wall.
And this was what year?
1977.
Your book ends there, and yeah. I have no idea what you've been doing since then. How have you made a living? What have you done with your life?
It's been very hit and miss. In the beginning, directly after leaving the Black Panther Party, it was very difficult, obviously, to suddenly become not a Panther and decide, what, I'm going to become a corporate executive, and what am I going to do? I've just been committed my entire life to a revolutionary change, and now I'll just take a job somewhere and settle into my life, and that'll be the end of that. So I could not do that. And I was very unhappy, and I was always unhappy to be alive. And what I did, I got a job from Suzanne DePass, my friend. She took care of me, essentially, for 2 years. And then I worked at a variety of jobs, and I went to law school, and I floundered around. I was really just sort of going from pillar to post in order to survive, and until it occurred to me that my daughter was still suffering because I was completely crazy in the manner that I was living, and I decided to go to therapy and start over again, which I did.
Elaine Brown, thank you very much for talking with us. I wish we had more time to talk.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being here. Really, I do.
Elaine Brown's new memoir is called A Taste of Power. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.